Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 90, section 5, which is old single column, page 992. Okay, we have this final section. As I mentioned at the end of the preceding session, a good measure of this section is really a preface to the next paper. You know, it's putting the finishing touches on the shamanism, on the phenomenon of shamans, by taking it all the way to priests. But, full-on priests. If you just think about that fact, between the lines of talking about a full-on priesthood, you have that fundamental aspect of any sophisticated religion, prayer. So, not surprising that it would just occur naturally in them in discussing the priesthood phenomenon that we would be segueing into prayer. So I don't, without any further ado on that, we'll have a lot of prefacing about prayer and stuff, especially once we get there. But let's just see the points that they want to make to set the stage here first.
5. Priests and rituals. The essence of the ritual is the perfection of its performance. Among savages, it must be practiced with exact precision. It is only when the ritual has been correctly carried out that the ceremony possesses compelling power over the spirits. If the ritual is faulty, it only arouses the anger and resentment of the gods. Therefore, since man's slowly evolving mind conceived that the technique of ritual was the decisive factor in its efficacy, it was inevitable that the early shamans should sooner or later evolve into a priesthood trained to direct the meticulous practice of the ritual. And so, for tens of thousands of years, endless rituals have hampered society and cursed civilization, have been an intolerable burden to every act of life, every racial undertaking.
Okay, so let's start with that final sentence everyone's chuckling about. We've been talking about that since the very beginning of this shamanism paper. What an incredible burden this whole addition is to evolutionary religion. And you have to take a deep breath and look very closely for the still small voice of a positive evolutionary phenomenon in the midst of a very loud cacophony of unfortunate phenomena in the individuals themselves, that the shamans eventually were just nothing but deceit. And then, like they're pointing out here, the elements of evolutionary religion that become so closely identified with them as the professionals, as they're pointing out here, you're going to be thinking about it in ever more exacting fashion, these rituals. And I mean, the only people that are going to be able to achieve this are those who dedicate their whole lives to it. Right? Because it's going to be an advanced skill. And they probably, it would be helpful if they started out with some natural ability in that direction, to begin with. And then, through lots of effort, can achieve the skill to do this to the point, as they were saying, that it is profoundly impressive to our animal origin minds. So let's look a little bit more at that part of it that they have at the beginning there. So this whole issue that among savages, it must be practiced with exact precision. Okay, before we focus on the exact precision part, notice the savages, not barbarians. Right. Okay, and think about how universally savage we are in this regard. I mean, what makes, a master in an Eastern art like Kung Fu very impressive, right? His exact precision and the sacredness with which he moves his body, one degree being off in the way, the angle on his hand, he knows exactly how every motion is supposed to be and where to stop and when to stop. That is about anything else you can think of like that, right? That's very, very impressive to our animal origin nature, that extreme precision. Now, and you go, well, why? I mean, if it's not obvious, I mean, is that something that just all of us notice that we're doing just naturally? Most of us are, tripping over things and breaking our toes, kicking stuff, and whatnot. And I mean, we're clumsy, pretty much by nature. So when we see someone who's doing something with such precision, and grace, I mean, we can't help it. Our jaw drops, and we stand in awe, right? See, that's the beginning of a religious sort of a sacredness to it, when you stand in awe of the material aspect of it, whether it's very bold and extreme in its material, like a volcano, or in this case, a little bit more sophisticated. Just very, very refined material form. Just how wonderfully delicately the stars seem to be laid out in the sky. It seems to have such a marvelous precision to it. We look at the sky and we stand in awe. And our primitive religious gears start turning. Yeah. So, this is just inescapable, and like I was saying, you don't have to do something that everyone sort of immediately says is a religious ritual. Just any sort of ritual that is effectively a religious ritual, because you're putting that reverence into it with the sixth adjutant and the precision into it with the fourth adjutant. Right, and so you have that full spectrum of individuality and unity with the longer term adjutants that is making for a very impressive phenomenon. And so if and all of our concept of the spirits, the gods, the whatevers, is all initially totally anthropomorphic. So when it says that it was, if it was correctly carried out, the ceremony possesses compelling power over the spirits. Why? Because you notice it has compelling power over you. Therefore, it must have compelling power over the spirits, because they're just exalted you. Right? You go from alive mortals to ghosts, to spirits, to gods, to God. Right? It's all just the ghost cult, right? Ever more aggrandized. So, it's in order for this to not be the basic mode, you have to completely break from that whole bottom-up predicate that has almost without exception has been the sum and substance of all of evolutionary religion for the last million years, for all of our million years. Right? It's just the tiny little bits of revelatory stuff that is, has managed to find some place in our evolutionary sphere. Okay, that's the only exception, right, to this, that we don't just have this very animal, exalted animal sort of sense about everything. Okay, You know, and so, you know, and then the opposite, like they're saying, you know, if it's faulty, that's obviously, quote unquote, right? Yeah, that's going to lead to anger and resentment of the gods. Because again, you're just thinking anthropomorphically. Boy, I hate it when it, you know, when it's, you know, when Bob doesn't march properly or whatever, right? You know, yeah, I mean, this is just the way we think. So obviously, God is going to be the same way, we say to ourselves. And so this whole technique, it's going to be a technique. So it's going to require these professionals who dedicate their whole lives, just like the martial arts master dedicates their whole life to achieving such incredibly impressive, demonstrations of skill. I mean, you have to devote your whole life to it. So you get a professional priesthood established. The meticulous practice of the ritual. And then notice the contrast in the modifiers. Okay, like at the end there, for tens of thousands of years, endless rituals have hampered society, okay, but cursed civilization. Okay, so that should catch your eye. If you're at all interested in civilization moving into, the second half of the whole evolutionary continuum of the progress of civilization, this is obviously, if you're still fraught with this basically animal fascination predicated ritual, rituality, whatever word you want to coin, you're tying yourself down, and you can't be moved forward into some sort of advancing civilization state. Okay, you've got to bring religion in as a purely inner life fact. Right? There are no rituals in the inner life. Rituals are a phenomenon of the lower domain in the hourglass analogy, manifesting out into the external world. That's where ritual is. There's no ritual in the upper domain. Yeah. All right, so, again, which reminds us, like, well, wait a minute. I thought worship was at the ceiling of the upper domain. Isn't there a lot of ritual in worship? Oh, when they use the word worship for that genuine worship on the sixth level of meaning, that must be something very different than what I think of when I hear the word worship. Because, boy, I think of ritual. Yeah. See, not only is there no ritual in the upper domain, but where worship genuinely is as far removed from the ritual in the lower domain as you can get, right? It's right up against the ceiling in the upper domain. You have to get as far away from ritual as possible to even have the beginnings of genuine worship.
How real ritualistic is Holy Communion, for instance, right, these days? It doesn't even have anything to do with how it started out.
Right. I mean, and
so ritualistic.
Think about, how evolutionarily Jesus is thinking when he establishes a ritual of the Remembrance Supper. Right, he's not ministering to someone, right about at the threshold of light and life. He knows what he's ministering to. At the end of his public ministry, after he's been totally disabused of all of his wonderful notions about what he was going to accomplish, right? Okay, he's boiled it down to the basics, right? And he knew they were still inescapably there in ritual, but he was going to try to, it's like, okay, throw out all of the thousands of rituals. Okay, I'm going to give you just one. I'm going to purify it. It's going to be simple, straightforward. It's going to have a more solid truth to it. Okay, can you boil it down to that anyway? Right. So that maybe there's enough of you left outside of ritual so that you can have an inner life. See? Because you just, you know, if you populate the entire landscape with ritual, there's just, you know, we're very finite beings, and you just use your whole self up. There's nothing left that can still get to an inner life. It's all used up in outer life phenomena. Okay, so this is very, very key. See, and notice it, the title is Priests and Rituals. The ritual is the foundational element. You know, the priesthood is really built upon, see, the foundation of rituals, what they're trying to remind you of there. You know, you can't really break away from, you know, shamans that are kind of priest-like in some of the things they do to just full-on professional priests until it is just fundamentally, foundationally about ritual first, and everything is on that foundation then.
That's kind of like the meat of his woe unto you in his last speech at the temple there, mm-hmm. where, you know, you clean the outsides, but the insides
are
filthy, so to speak.
Right, clean hands and not clean hearts. Right? Again, the whole ritual of cleaning the hands, you know, as it were, you know, not paying attention to the inner life, the heart. But like I was pointing out, you pay so much attention to the clean hands and whatnot stuff, you don't have anything left. We're all very limited. It's like I was saying, in order to achieve this exacting precision, I mean, you have to dedicate your whole life to it. You can't just do that. You know, I mean, you can't achieve that, you know, just as a passing little thing. You got to... Yeah, most of your life has to be, you know, dedicated to that. If you're going to achieve that level, yeah. You're not going to be champion golfer. You know, the first time you pick up the clubs. Yeah. It's all very understandable, but it's important to emphasize of what you know. You know, why they're so strong there at the end, you know, about it cursing civilization, you know, this intolerable burning. I mean, why are they laying it on so heavy? Because it's just, you got to understand the physics of it to see why it's so strong like that. Okay, what else do they say? Oh, you got something?
John Stevens is asking, does spontaneity characterize the upper domain?
Yes, I mean, spontaneous literally means of free will. Okay, and genuine spontaneity, you know, in the sense of originality, the originality of your personality, not the illusion of spontaneity and free will because you have. Basically a random phenomenon generator in the lower domain because you've severed it from any cosmic integrity, and so it just is flopping around and doing, remember, that's what's always been so impressive, and those are the people that became the shamans, the ones that don't have much grounding in the cosmos and to the upper domain, and their bottom domain is, you know, spasmodically flying or flopping around, and everyone goes, make that person the shaman. Okay, so not quote-unquote spontaneous like that, where you never know when the person is going to go off on some psychotic tangent.
Okay.
Okay. But genuine originality, spontaneity. Remember, I often have to point that out when it's really important when you see the revelators use that word. They want you to think about the literalness of it when they use it. Okay, what else do we have here?
Ritual is the technique of sanctifying custom. Ritual creates and perpetuates myths, as well as contributing to the preservation of social and religious customs. Again, ritual itself has been fathered by myths. Rituals are often at first social, later becoming economic, and finally acquiring the sanctity and dignity of religious ceremonial. Ritual may be personal or group in practice, or both, as illustrated by prayer, dancing, and drama.
Okay, this is a very interesting paragraph. The little things they throw in there. So notice how they start out. Okay, immediately following the cursing civilization and the intolerable and all that, you know, then they remind you of the flip side, okay, in the evolutionary context. Ritual is a technique for sanctifying custom. You're going, well, I don't know, is that important? Well, ritual creates and perpetuates myths as well as contributing to the preservation of social and religious customs. Okay. It's like, well, shouldn't we be conserving? Well, okay, before we can get to the fancier thing of conserving, we need to at least be preserving, right? We have to be in some mode, not just an animal that's, you know, totally in the moment, and then the next moment is utterly divorced from the previous moment. And right. I mean, there has to get some sort of a plank spread out through time. Okay? And you're obviously going to start by dragging the past forward as preservation. But it's, you know, it's a beginning.
And so conservation to keep the good parts.
Right. Conservation is when you're, you know, you bring in the creativity, you know, and the insight to be able to take the truth of the past forward into the future. And not literally try to take the fact of the past forward into the future, which is, you know, a fool's errand. Okay, so, you know, so that, anyway, so they're pointing out that, you know, you wouldn't have this inescapable fact of ritual as in the evolutionary phenomenon if it wasn't serving a purpose in the early stages of evolution. So they're reminding you some of those. They'll give you some more here in a little bit. Now, notice the fascinating thing that they did. See, here's where, if you've started to become attuned to what they tell you in the third paragraph of the book, third paragraph of the foreword, the very first thing that they reveal to you, that there's a threefold actuality, right? If you've started to become attuned to that, you know, you'll notice that they're mentioning three things here. Rituals are often at first social, later becoming economic, and finally acquiring sanctity and dignity of religious ceremonial. Think a little bit about that. So the first, you know, social, okay, that's the associativity. I mean, economic, you know, that's a science, that's an individuality mode. And of course, when you bring in religious, okay, that's unity. Oh, it's in the same order that we always do truth, beauty, goodness. Right? So that's kind of an interesting thing that they're pointing out that remember what I always point out about the truth, beauty, goodness, why it's in that order. You know, that's the existential triplet. So you have to have some measure of top-down view to even get to that triplet, right? You have to get to the existential first. And so, you know, inescapably, if you think about, you know, the individuality and the unity side by side, the beauty and the goodness side by side, you know, and then having the super additive consequence of truth above it, if you're approaching that triangle, you know, that triplet from the top down, you hit truth first, and then you're a material identity, so you go to the individuality next, and then finally you get to the unity, truth, beauty, goodness. So notice that they're putting them in the same order here. So that's kind of an interesting little augmentation of telling you that it has these three different modes to it, or this series of modes to it.
How'd you figure that out?
Again, it's just like I said. Once you become attuned, you know, and you're always you're always looking for that. You know, that's why this chart is always sitting next to me to remind you to always be looking for the threefold pattern. It's the most fundamental thing. It's that, like I said, it's the very first thing they reveal to you. In the entire Revelation.
So as a Melchizedek yep. writing this, it's almost natural for it to come out.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Right. So he's naturally going to be doing more than just kind of recounting history. He's going to be very philosophical. Okay. So to just, you know, delight in noticing little details like that when they're thrown in. Okay, and then, sure enough, we only made it two paragraphs in, and we found prayer. Ritual may be personal or a group in practice or both, as illustrated by prayer, dancing, and drama. Okay, so the first thing is, wait a minute. I don't think of prayer as a ritual. Matter of fact, I don't like that. how dare they assault prayer by calling it that word that I've come to really kind of denigrate, ritual. I'm a free-form, liberated human, you're saying to yourself. And I've gotten rid of all that ritual of institutionalized religion or whatever. Yeah. No, just let's read the beginning of that paragraph with replacing the word ritual by prayer. Prayer is the technique of sanctifying custom. Prayer creates and perpetuates myths, as well as contributing to the preservation of social and religious customs. Again, prayer itself has been fathered by myths. Prayers are often at first social, later becoming economic, and finally acquiring the sanctity and dignity of religious ceremonial. Yeah, see? Especially at the end there. Yeah. Right. We've already been talking about that, as we've been foreshadowing paper 91, the next paper. Right, you start out with a prayer with a social predicate to it, and then you get around to prayers that are economic, please God, make it rain, because, if the crops don't grow this year, we're going to lose the farm. Okay? All right? It's an economic prayer.
So could you do the same thing with dancing?
Right. I mean, and dancing and drama, right? I mean, again, playing in these modes, yes. See, they won't be boilerplate, they expect you to be on your toes enough that you can go back and, prayer is a ritual. So I could replace the word ritual in those previous, and then, then I can really, there's a lot of places in the book that they expect you to construct the additional sentences that should be self-evident to you, right? From what they say. And it's often very, very helpful when you do. Okay, so now, before I go any further, because I already pointed out that just calling prayer a ritual seems kind of prickly, let's foreshadow where we're going, a little bit more with the next paper. It's very, very important, right up front, to recognize that prayer is a very fundamental element throughout the entire span of human civilization, from the very first two humans to the seventh stage of light and life. Okay, it spans the entire spectrum. But that spectrum has two phases: the first phase, and a subsequent phase. And in that first phase, what's called prayer, even though like they're pointing out right here, is very important for keeping things going, making sure that you carry forward stuff that needs to be carried forward, whatnot. That kind of prayer is bottom-up prayer. It's coming literally up out of your genetics, right? As they tell you up in part four, right? Prayer is something that the life carriers designed into your DNA. That initial prayer, All right, that bottom-up prayer, that literally the kind of prayer that I can replace the word ritual in a sentence with that kind of prayer. But the prayer that you have a vague sense that's actually giving you the tension that you feel when they just called prayer a ritual, that's the prayer that the Revelators would like you to discover fully. And you can't if you don't eliminate your, you know, the bondage you've put the word prayer into in its ritual beginnings, in its genetic foundation beginnings, where you're literally programmed to do that initial prayer, right? I mean, you're literally just a machine, an automaton in that initial mode of prayer. No matter how spontaneous, quote unquote, it might seem to be, right? It's not really. So when you're feeling this tension, don't take it personally. And I'm meaning that literally. The tension is to remind you that the person should be seeking that second phase prayer and transcending the animal that naturally does the first phase prayer. That's just ritual. That literally, like I said, I mean, the degree to which a ritual sounds like something that an automaton does because it's programmed, yeah, see, it's literally the case. I mean, prayer more than many other things, you know, prayer is one of those things they literally tell you is literally designed into you. Some of the other stuff kind of comes, it's always on every planet because it's just kind of the way the environment and creatures interact and whatnot. The prayer thing is just, it's just literally innate in you, okay? And that initial prayer. When we get to the next paper, a little ways in, we'll get to that third indispensable. You know, we've seen of the second phase, of the advancing phase of civilization. We've seen true religion, we've seen true monogamy. The next is prayer. But it's obviously not the kind of prayer that can be a substitute word for the word ritual. If it's in the advancing phase, this has got to be something very top-down. I mean, there's only one thing follows it in the sequence, true religion, true monogamy, prayer. God consciousness is what follows it in the sequence, which is something basically that humans can't even imagine. Okay, it's so transcendent, what the Revelators mean by God consciousness. So, Whenever you're feeling a resistance to what they're saying, it's like, I don't like the way they're denigrating prayer here. They're not denigrating the prayer that your personal inner life yearns for. They're reminding you that it's not the prayer that comes naturally to you. Right? They want you to become disillusioned with the natural prayer, so that you will seek something greater. A prayer that mankind has not yet discovered, really. Something that is genuinely directed towards the inner life.
Yeah. Dear God,
I'm going to live in a Mercedes Benz. Do you think starting out with the natural prayer starts you on a path where you might continue up?
You can't get to this unnatural prayer without starting with the natural prayer that's programmed into you. It's one of the reasons why it's programmed into you.
You don't give up the first one until you've got a grasp on the second one.
He's like, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, and it's like I said. I mean, it's so indispensable being able to get to that true, genuine prayer phenomenon we're talking about that the life carriers don't just say, "Well, I'm pretty sure that something in the environment, you know, will stimulate him in just the way and get it going." No, they can't count on that. They have to make it environment independent. And literally just put it purely inside of you, you will pray, right? in the absence of any, right, external, you know, catalyzing of it or whatever, right?
I've always been kind of puzzled about the evolutionary level and how the universal controller, which is non-personal pattern, and we're talking about evolutionary religion, it's really more material than it is spiritual.
Yes.
And it's without revelation, it's pure. It'd be purely a natural. It's a natural phenomenon. Nothing artificial.
Yeah. You're right, but you know, you take something that seemingly is not very inspiring to your religious desires. Something called the universal controller, but when you recognize just what you're saying, okay, you want to get to religion of spirit,
yeah.
But you can't just be there. You start with religion of matter, then you have to go through a long, complicated religion of mind, and then finally you can culminate in religion of spirit. It's like, well, how is, you know, what sees to the fact that it will go like that, that it will roll out like that? I mean, something must be basically potentializing the religion of matter phenomenon so that it will eventually end up as religion of spirit. Yeah, what if there was an over-controller of matter? So that coincidentally, matter has this kind of insidious conspiracy to it. That it's a predicate for greater things. See, that's why you have that over-control phenomenon like that. Right? It's not just for the immediacy of the material. It is partly that. I mean, some of the things that I say mechanical controllers are, you know, doing, it seems to be very much just kind of for the immediacy of the matter in front of them. But there's always higher elements in play, right? Some that are sort of laying out the grand plan, like master architects, and everyone just kind of goes with the plan. They don't know why, but they, you know, they follow the plan. But then there's more hands-on stuff that's seeing to it that there's more to the material than just the moment. Right? That it's something that can be evolved. Right? So, right, I mean, you know, when you think about that relationship of the universal controller to kind of the immediacy of where we are, and that'll help you to understand what God the Father is up to through that facet of deity.
Three chairs for Gene. Yes.
No, I mean, that's the universe becomes very glorious when you begin to add in deity to reality. Everything about reality is just so cool then. Right? We could go on for hours. Right? But anyway, back to priests, these fancy boat anchors. Okay, and prayer. So we're that's going to be what we're going to be looking for as we get into prayer in greater depth is that contrast between how it begins naturally, where something is happening in spite of ourselves, you know, to where something will happen because of ourselves eventually, and can be one of the four indispensables for advancing civilization. Okay, what else do they give us here?
Words become a part of ritual, such as the use of terms like amen and salah. The habit of swearing profanity represents a prostitution of former ritualistic repetition of holy names. The making of pilgrimages to sacred shrines is a very ancient ritual. The ritual next grew into elaborate ceremonies of purification, cleansing, and sanctification. The initiation ceremonies of the primitive tribal secret societies were in reality a crude religious rite. The worship technique of the olden mystery cults was just one long performance of accumulated religious ritual. Ritual finally developed into the modern types of social ceremonials and religious worship. Services embracing prayer, song, responsive reading, and other individual and group spiritual devotions.
Okay. So let's just go through that in order. You start with those, words that add a little punch, a little emphasis with prayers, like amen and salah. If you're not familiar, salah is, you know, this word that's thrown in at the end of lines in Psalms, you know, that's salah. It's just that, emphasizing word. And you add it in this ritualistic fashion with all this precision and all this, and you won't be able to help yourself. It will feel sanctified by that act. Okay? You'll go, ooh, I'm really doing something that's going to affect the spirits now.
They used that in the children's sermon at church last Sunday. The pastor had the kids come down, and he would read like a phrase or two of the prayer, and then he would give them a cue, and then they would play their instruments, and they would say salah. He would say salah, and then they would play these little musical instruments, make a big bracket, and then he'd do some more, and he'd say salah, and then they would, celebrate. It was adorable.
Yeah, and that's actually him literalizing, one thought. People have speculated about that word, about whether or not it was a musical cue. He's taking that literally, and having them act it out. Notice how they're putting it here. It's obvious what the deal is here. You can say that, amen, let it be so. It's this affirmation thing. But set aside any sort of technical details for a second. Get to the truth of what the words are doing. Like I said, they're making it so that you won't be able to help yourself. It will feel so sanctified when you've put those in there like that. And then there's little tidbits like swearing, being as you're saying, a prostitution of ritualistic use of words. And notice parenthetically they throw in profanity. Why do they do that? That's one of those where they're wanting you to reflect on the literalness of the word. Okay. Literally profane means, the pro means before the temple. In other words, you're outside of the temple. Right? The inner sanctum is in front of you, right? You're outside the temple, right? So it's just, you take something that's in the temple and you flip it 180 degrees outside the temple, right? So there's lots of things that are, that we have that started on the inside, if you will, and we're flipped to the outside as a, in some perversion, turning them all the way through, some sort of a perversion, effort.
When people swear, it's usually in those moments when they're not in their right mind, they're not thinking about what cognizant of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They forget themselves.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, they add little tidbits like this so that you can kind of get the recognition of truth flowing. You just work through this kind of the science of the word a little bit, and then it's like the whole sentence kind of comes alive more in your mind. They're trying to do that all the time. Like I pointed out, the little science of the associativity, individuality, unity triplet there and stuff like that. That's all, initially it seems like you're bogging yourself down to kind of focus on the science of it, but then now combine that with the poetry you were feeling and see if you get a more profound experience out of what's being said. All right. So you got pilgrimages and another ritual, and you got purification and cleansing and sanctification and initiation ceremonies, all these things. Now, then they, of course, they bring it right to the worship service that's happening every Sunday all around us. So the worship technique of the olden mystery cults was just one long performance of accumulated religious ritual. And I think everyone here knows, that when you're talking, especially when you're talking about Christianity, right, it began Catholicism, that what we now call the Catholic Church, began in terms of what it did and all the technicalities of the worship, basically just taking what the mystery cults had, Mithraism especially, and just taking it over, running with it, just completely confiscating it. Cultural appropriation, we call it these days, right? That's kind of the most immediate thing in the Christian tradition. Why, despite Jesus's efforts to try to get priests out of the way between you and God by saying he's your spiritual father, right? I mean, there's nothing in between a father and a child. It goes directly from father to son, from father to child, right? Trying to get the priests out of there. But, of course, that didn't, he was had almost no success there. Because even if you go to a Protestant church and, a mainline Protestant church, and you toss out some of the literal Mithraic ritual things, it's still, like they're saying in the final sentence there, that ritual finally developed into the modern types of social ceremonials and religious worship services, embracing prayer, song, responsive reading, and other individual and group spiritual devotions. You're going, well, of course, that's what worship is. Oh, but they seem to be saying no, right? That's all just ritual. Right? It's like, well, how do you know? Well, because it's all outer life. Okay? All of these things, these are things that are visible, that you're manifesting. It's not that that's innately bad, but what you're seeking is the substance, not the shadow that the substance casts. It's not what gets manifested. You're seeking for that genuine religious life that's purely in the inner life and is not visible. Right? You want to get to the point where if I say to you, that person is very religious, if your first thought is, I don't see it, then you don't understand what I'm saying. Religion is something that can't be seen. Genuine religion. That's what humans have yet to figure out. The only way that I can know someone is religious, genuine religious, is through insight, the recognition of insight. It's nothing I can see. What you see, we call, the hallmarks of a religious person, that's ghost cult piety. Right? We need to distinguish between, religiosity, genuine religiosity, and ghost cult piety. Right? There's lots of ghost cult piety around. People have dedicated their whole lives to, like we're just talking about. Right? And so you can ask some really probing questions. Okay, the Pope is Pope because of his very, very advanced ghost cult piety, but is he religious at all? I don't know, I never thought about it. Yeah, see, because it's nothing you can see. You need to pause and reflect and use some insight. Try to figure out, is he actually religious? Or is he just a very skilled ghost cult piety professional? Right? Right? Maybe he's, maybe, you know, he's really focused on social justice. Well, it's not that there doesn't need to be people focused on social justice, but... Okay, that's not a manifestation of fundamental religious nature. Okay, Gene first here.
I feel the need to make confession. What time is Gene? I long ago recognized I go to church regularly.
Yep.
Regularity of it. I'm so undisciplined.
Uh-huh.
That helps give discipline to my life.
Yeah.
And the same reason I come to Friday night religiously.
Yes.
Know, because I'm so undisciplined. I feel like if I didn't, I would just drift.
Yeah. And that's a great testimonial. And if there's anyone in the room that thinks, oh, I'm not like that, no, of course you're like that. Yeah, that's the animalist is like that. I mean, they kind of were making that point. You know, this if there isn't regular ritual for the animal part of you, right? You prefer to serve two masters. Don't pretend there's anything different. Okay. There's no way to have that animal be disciplined at all. I mean, we need that ritual, right? If you throw out going to church every Sunday, you will notice it's more difficult for you to kind of stay in the material game.
Well, I'd like to make one little
question. Yeah. Yep.
The animal nature wants to be disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
It really does.
It does, yes.
Yeah, it thrives on
discipline. Yeah. I mean, the child may seem to not want discipline, but they really do. And they desperately need it. Right? The child actually knows, unlike the delusional parent, the child actually knows that he started with a blank slate. The delusional parent that thinks, oh, we need to let the natural child just manifest. He's got this fully written slate, and we just need to let him pour it out upon us. It's like, no, he starts with a blank slate. Okay? And the child knows that, basically, and he actually knows that he needs a framework that only parents can give him. Right? No matter how much the little rebellious aspect, the animal with a sixth adjutant, doesn't want to stay between the lines. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. And then you had one. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. So.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have, a framework to help us with our animal nature, that's awesome, and I think that's important. And I think that it would just help, I'm thinking about, church services I've been to, and I noticed that it's really rare or never that you're encouraged to stop and reflect and reach higher. Know that there's more. Be encouraged to go up.
Yeah. In and up. Yeah.
Sometimes I think that sometimes there is some alluding in that direction, but I think that's really rare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of the time, you want to keep the animal in the game, and so there's got to be lots of razzmatazz, going on, or the animal just falls asleep. Doesn't there need to be more bass in that, in that musical number, to keep the animal from falling asleep. So, but we have to remember, like they're saying, all that stuff drags you down and out, right? No matter how much you add reverence, you know, and hence a feeling of sanctification to, you know, the outer life ritual. I mean, again, you know, reverence is a long way up from just raw animal fear, but it's still in the lower domain. Right?
Yeah, it's like so, it's like you look at a picture, and when you look at the picture to see the true artistry of it, you actually begin with the picture, and you're seeing beyond the truth right. through the picture.
Right.
And I think it's
kind of
like that.
Yes, it is. Right? See, all these things, the animal, these things, all these things, can, these outer life things can be very helpful to get the animal in a potentialized state. But then don't let it be an end in itself. You know, let it be a beginning to something that only the human can do, predicated on a coordinated animal, you know, so a primed animal. Right? You know, you can go up. So, remember in the Jesus papers, Jesus knew a lot of these techniques of how to kind of manipulate the animal a little bit. So he had some hope of maybe having him stand on that primed animal, you know, and getting something higher. You know, I mean, there's a role for emotional appeal, but you have to be very careful with it because it can quickly get away from you and become an end in itself. You know, so you have to prime the animal a little bit like that. Get him up there onto the level of the feelings, because you can't jump from the first level of meaning to the third. I mean, you got to go through the second. So you have to go up through feelings. So you have to prime the pump and getting some sublime feelings going. But you know, then you got to make sure they don't get stuck there, right? That they go through that and continue up. All right.
Back to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. This thing about accumulated religious ritual and what you were saying.
Yeah.
It seems like maybe one part of the reason Catholic Church has been able to assimilate so many kind of like indigenous
mm-hmm.
type religions is just that that's what it started with to begin with.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just more of the same, just kind of just soaking up.
Yeah, it's a very clever, in some ways, multiculturalism, you could say, with, you know, at least until recently, a heavy dose of authoritarianism, you know, ladled on top of that to hold it together ruthlessly at times. Okay, but yeah, it's, you know, they were really looking to be as universally bottom up as possible. Right? I mean, that's why they call themselves the Catholic Church, right? The universal church. You know, we can start with anyone's evolutionary religion and take you up. You know, there's a rationalization scheme to take you from where you are to, to where we'd like you to go.
So, which is probably why it has persisted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Valuable function.
It is. See, and it's kind of an inescapable first step to take the best of what you can find and everything and kind of bring it together and up. You know, it's kind of like taking many gods together and up into one god, right? That initial process. But then, you know, once you're kind of bringing things together and it's starting to look like the bottom is coming into the neck of the hourglass, okay, follow that up and expand it out again, you know, and be born again into a new ever-expanding space, you know, and don't just let it get stuck, you know, in some absolute authoritarian peak point, right, that holds the pyramid together underneath. All right, let's keep going here.
The priests evolved from shamans up through oracles, diviners, singers, dancers, weather makers, guardians of religious relics, temple custodians, and foretellers of events, to the status of actual directors of religious worship. Eventually, the office became hereditary. A continuous priestly caste arose.
Okay. Just notice one little thing kind of fits into what we were just saying before we started reading. Priests evolved from shamans up through. See, it's just that. Yeah, that's like that picture I was just trying to paint. You've got all these different things, and you know, and to think about a coordinating influence that's drawing them synthetically together and up into some focus, see, that can match up with the gateway that is the neck of the hourglass and take you up, right, to higher things. And that's the way the evolutionary process is always working, in that mode. Whether it's biologic or religious evolution, doesn't matter what it is. That's the way evolution works. Yep.
As religion evolved, priests began to specialize according to their innate talents or special predilections. Some became singers, others prayers, and still others sacrificers. Later came the orators, preachers. And when religion became institutionalized, these priests claimed to hold the keys of heaven.
And I already mentioned that specialization stuff. Obviously, a lot of times if you have an initial, you know, like they're saying, predilection, you know, an initial genetic tendency, an initial temperament in a certain direction, you know, an initial ability can be built upon and honed into an advanced skill. So obviously that's going to be the way it played out, and they're just telling you, sure enough, it did. And that final hold the keys of heaven, you know, that's bordering on blasphemy. Because, you know, what are we talking about there? That's when, you know, in Matthew, it says that Jesus said that Peter, you know, is going to be, you know, that he's going to be called Peter, the rock. Right, and the church is going to be founded on him, and I'm handing you the keys of heaven, right? And if that which you join together is eternally joined together, and that which you, you know, take apart is eternally taken apart, right? Right, that you know God's power is in your hands. I mean, it's, you know, see, like, oh. You know, you just read this like, oh, Jesus didn't know. Okay. right, that's been aggrandized there. Right, and sure, Jesus renamed him Peter. But to take it all the way to, now you hold the keys of heaven, might be a little bit, you know, of the priesthood speaking, not Jesus, huh? Yeah. And that's what's going on there. Right.
The priests have always sought to impress and awe the common people by conducting the religious ritual in an ancient tongue and by sundry magical passes, so to mystify the worshippers as to enhance their own piety and authority. The great danger in all this is that the ritual tends to become a substitute for religion.
Yeah, like we were talking about, obviously, you know, you're so bound to the outer life stuff of ritual, you just can't get to the inner life. It's too much of a boat anchor. And again, all of these techniques, like, you know, they're reminding you again, remember we talked about that, the shamans, through experiential hard knocks, if they didn't discover clever techniques, they were executed. Okay, so all kinds of clever techniques, you know, of, you know, they figured out that, you know, if I move my hand in a certain way, you just can't help it. You go, ooh, that's so mysterious. Right, you know, and so, you know, whether it's, you know, making the sign of the cross or any other ritualistic movement of a hand, you know, these, as they're saying there, these magical passes of the hand. You know, all of that impresses the animal in you, because there's no apparent, you know, it's like, why is he moving his hand so precisely like that? It's like he's holding on to something, but I don't see anything. Oh, there must be something invisible that he hasn't hold of. Ooh, it's very mysterious, and I'm very impressed. Okay? That's what you can't help but react that way.
Are they called mudras in maybe Buddhism?
Yeah, right? I mean, every evolutionary religion has this because they all come from the shamans, and right, they just get this advanced specialization when it's more priests, right, than shamans. Whether it's Buddhism or, you know, Christianity or whatever it is. You know, not to mention the affectations of garments and, you know, all the other stuff that goes along with it. Let's see here, what else we have? And like I said, it's easy to enhance their own piety and authority. Like I said, this well-developed ghost cult piety phenomenon that, you know, whenever we see that, we go, oh, that's a very religious person. Gee, you've got to challenge yourself to not think that way. I'll guarantee you, someone who is very definitively, genuinely religious is most likely the last person you'd think, because you're looking for the animal in you, and the trained animal after a million years is looking for ghost cult piety. And that genuinely religious person is going to manifest probably almost no ghost cult piety. And so you're going to conclude they're the most irreligious person on the planet. You need to look deeper, right? Look for things about their outer life that don't have any explanation if they don't have a solid inner life. Right, peace that passes all understanding, for instance. They can have zero ghost cult piety and be very genuinely religious. All right, a little more here.
The priesthoods have done much to delay scientific development and to hinder spiritual progress, but they have contributed to the stabilization of civilization and to the enhancement of certain kinds of culture. But many modern priests have ceased to function as directors of the ritual of the worship of God, having turned their attention to theology, the attempt to define God.
Oh, this doesn't seem like it's getting better, does it? It went from directors of the ritual of the worship of God to the attempt to define God. Yeah. And obviously you're gonna go there without even thinking about it, because after all, you hold the keys of heaven. Jesus said so. You're in an unbroken line of laying on of hands of descent from Peter or whatever, right? Okay, yeah, it's all very, yeah, and they didn't have to invent that self-aggrandizement. Like they point out, the shamans before them became masters of self-aggrandizement. It's just following in that tradition. It definitely goes to, you know, this stuff goes to our heads. You start to believe your own magical passes of your hand. Ooh, I think I really am doing something when I move my hand in that woo-woo way. But notice, you know, between the lines there, okay? They have done much to delay scientific development and to hinder spiritual project progress, but... Okay? We don't want to ever forget about the evolutionary goodness of these seemingly bad things. Right? All this stuff plays a role in a long-term process. Okay, finish it up there.
It is not denied that the priests have been a millstone about the neck of the races, but the true religious leaders have been invaluable in pointing the way to higher and better realities.
Okay, and there's the this but sentence again, and it's exactly what we were, you know, talking about just a minute ago. They're a beginning to something greater, and you kind of need to need to sort of pile up the animal like that, no matter how foolish it is, so that you have that pinnacle to stand on to reach up to higher things. It's just kind of the way we are. If we'd gotten the full biologic uplift, right, it wouldn't be so much so, right? You just stand at a higher platform. You don't have to have some foolish little pyramid, you know, that you stand on balance at the top of, right, anymore, right? You know, we would have just been moved up, But we haven't been. So even Jesus, like they point out in part four, the only way he got to the genuine religious life that he had was by slowly being piled up from a little child by the evolutionary religion he was born into, with all of its intense ritual and, you know, and notions of sanctification and purification and whatnot. Right? That's the only way little Jesus got to be the glorious, you know, man that did all those wonderful things that they can write about. Right? You know, and they emphasize that in that one spot when they, you know, he's giving that sermon in the synagogue, and you know, they don't give you anything that he actually said. All they give you is all of the minutia of the ritual to remind you that, you know, that's what got him to where he was. And you're delusional if you think you can somehow just skip all of that. You need to be piled up by the evolutionary process first, and so that there's a predicate for you to reach higher. Okay, let's get into prayer proper here, paper 91. Oh, and I don't know if you read the byline there, did you?
Presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
I almost forgot about it because John already mentioned it, and I was thinking about it in my head already. Yeah, notice that this is not, you know, flip back to the previous papers. You remember, you know, like what 89 was? You know, they're all presented by a brilliant evening star of Nebadon. Okay, we've gone from this brilliant evening star to this one. We've got a Melchizedek. When we're talking about these the persons and not just the concepts and stuff, the evolution of the concepts, like we did, when you actually get to the persons, they put it in the hands of Melchizedek to do the authorship. So that's kind of an interesting thing to think about. And, you know, actually, before we even read this paper, look at the surprise when you flip to the end of this paper. Yeah, who wrote this paper? It's really out of the blue in this evolutionary religion set. Presented by the chief of the ranch of Midwares? So it's very interesting. It's like to pick an author that's as close to us as possible.
And also they would have the same sort of genetic predisposition of prayer, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. See, it's as close to us as possible. Okay? That's an interesting little twist. that this is... you know, you can kind of think of this as, you know, this author knows of that which he speaks because he's kind of, lifted up sort of to the heights of what we can lift ourselves up to and properly contextualize, properly framed. Yep.
What's the difference between a brilliant evening star and an evening star?
No difference, just whether or not they, yeah, I mean,
time of day.
Yeah, you know, they're just, you know, since it's the same one, you know, doing them, you know, they weren't boilerplate in the repetition of it. All right, anyway, back to the paper. What do we have here?
Maybe it wasn't such a brilliant one.
He heard that. She didn't mean it. Not so brilliant evening star. Okay.
Paper 91, The Evolution of Prayer. Prayer as an agency of religion evolved from previous non-religious monologue and dialogue expressions. With the attainment of self-consciousness by primitive man, there occurred the inevitable corollary of other consciousness, the dual potential of social response and God recognition.
Okay, so we'll get, you know, they'll explain more of the monologue-dialogue issue as we go forward. But it just reminds you, like I said, they're telling you right up front, it's going to begin from non-religious expressions because it's just programmed into you. Okay, so just your basic, you know, animal origin nature is going to start to manifest this without any sort of fanciness that can be called a religious context as a predicate for it, okay? And you're just going to be talking to yourself, right? And you don't know why. It's because you were programmed, right, to just start talking like this. Okay, so we've already fleshed out a lot of what's between the lines of what they're saying there. And then they add in that higher thing. So, and this is an important point that, you know, they bring out philosophically, you know, and it's actually tying into to human philosophy beyond the Urantia book as well, that you know, if you get all the way up to genuine objective consciousness above yourself, so that you have genuine full self-consciousness, you don't just get that. You know, the moment that you're up there, you're now that you have a window to beyond yourself, right? Well, you're still down in yourself, you don't really, but you, so you have to get above before you really can see any other, whether it's one of the others in front of you in the room here, right, or the other, and that God consciousness, yeah, potential, right, starting with God knowingness, right. So, and that's what they're saying. So, you know, the dual potential of social response and God recognition, right? And you can recognize you have a duty to others. You have an ethical duty, you know, and you have a duty to the other. You have a religious duty. But it all began by getting up and becoming aware of the cosmos and your, you know, the fact that you're an object in it. You're a self in that cosmos. You know, all of that other consciousness is, you know, starts with that contextualization of yourself, with that moral recognition of moral duty, a duty to the cosmos. So that's you know, they're obviously, you know, even if it isn't very definitive, there has to be some measure of I am, right, of that existential kind of reinitialization of yourself consciously, you know, like we saw with them giving you the associativity, individuality, unity triplet from the top down like that, right? Like we were saying, so to get to anything that you could say is kind of genuine prayer, even in the sense of the first phase, there's got to be some sort of foundational objectivity, right? So that's, they're reminding you that in the very first paragraph, see? Yeah. You know, even in a very kind of slightly advanced philosophic mode to get you to think about the inevitable corollary of other consciousness, you know, to speak that way, see? To speak so logically like that. Okay.
The earliest prayer forms were not addressed to deity. These expressions were much like what you would say to a friend as you entered upon some important undertaking. Wish me luck. Primitive man was enslaved to magic, luck, good and bad, entered into all the affairs of life. At first, these luck petitions were monologues, just a kind of thinking out loud by the magic server. Next, these believers in luck would enlist the support of their friends and family, and presently some form of ceremony would be performed, which included the whole clan or tribe.
See, so it just gets started like that, you know, and just reminding you of that programming, you know, you just blurt out, wish me luck. Hey, those little things like that, it's all because of that programming. You know, and you go, why am I verbalizing like that? if you just pause and think about it for a second, you know, and you just seem like you can't help yourself. You want to do that because you're programmed that way. They're showing, and it quickly gets going. Initially, you're just talking to yourself like you're a crazy person. But pretty soon, the whole group joins in, the whole clan or the whole tribe, and it's, you know, and you've got the process going. All right.
When the concepts of ghosts and spirits evolved, these petitions became superhuman in address, and with the consciousness of God, such expressions attained to the levels of genuine prayer. As an illustration of this, among certain Australian tribes, primitive religious prayers antedated their beliefs in spirits and superhuman personalities.
All right, so because we have this, we have people almost all the way back on square one, and those who are imagining light and life all on this planet at the same time, and they're pointing out, you know, you can see basically people in all these different stages, you know, alive today. You know, even ones that are clear back there, and they're praying. You can, you know, and as an anthropologist, you can go there and watch them praying, but you notice, huh, they have no belief in spirits or superhuman personalities or anything. Well, that's weird. Why are they praying? It's almost like they're programmed to pray. You, if you were reflecting, you might say to yourself, see, you could actually deduce this by just observation. It's like, wait a minute, I think someone programmed us to pray. I can't see any reason why these people would be so, you know, so prayerful. And they don't have any fancy supernatural notion going on in their heads. Right? Yeah. So it's just right there to see, be recognized by observation, what we're, you know, this physics that they reveal in the book. But notice that they did, you know, if it finally gets to, see, even though you've got this exalted ghost thing that you're calling capital G God, the very fact that you kind of boil it down to a monotheistic God, you give it a capital G, you, even if you haven't gotten a hold of the substance consciously on the sixth level of meaning, you're a hold of its real shadow. And when your prayer becomes predicated on that, the essence, you know, of the substance that's in that shadow, it, you can call it genuine prayer. Yeah. But still, all those things I said earlier are in place. Even though it's genuine prayer, it's just the first phase genuine prayer. Right? The second phase genuine prayer is where you're not just responding to the shadow, but you're responding to the substance. And that's what we need to get to. We need to get it so that the proper definition of the word faith is in the dictionary, for instance, right? Where we've actually seen the substance and not just the shadow. The substance of faith, not just the shadow of faith. Right? The substance of God, not just the shadow of God. That's the second phase. Prayer and everything else that goes with it. Okay?
The Toda tribe of India now observes this practice of praying to no one in particular, just as did the early peoples before the times of religious consciousness. Only among the Todas, this represents a regression of their degenerating religion to this primitive level. The present-day rituals of the dairymen priests of the Todas do not represent a religious ceremony, since these impersonal prayers do not contribute anything to the conservation or enhancement of any social, moral, or spiritual values.
Right, so I mentioned anthropologists, you know, and we're going to get, you know, all this, you know, like many places in these evolution papers, they throw out these anthropological sorts of passages. You know, so you've got the Toda people in, you know, in southern India. You know, and I don't really need to say much else. You know, they're in southern India, so you know, okay, there's not a lot of Andite uplift, right? And so they're going to be in a fairly primitive stage, and they're pointing out they're even going backwards. You know, and they've actually kind of lost all of the higher evolutionary stuff, and they've gone back to where they're, you know, praying to no one in particular, as they say there, right? And, you know, and of course, that whole bit of, holy cow, right? You know, literally, right? I mean, you've got the holy dairy and the holy milkman. And right, I mean, you know, the Todas, right? This is, you know, this is what is very, very sanctified. The milk, is just supreme in their minds. I mean, I'm not being facetious. Now, literally, you literally have a quote-unquote holy dairy and a holy milkman. I mean, literally. Not anyone can milk, the cow. I mean, there has to be, right? It's a ritualistic, professional job. Okay. But as they're saying, see, obviously, this is not going to have much consequence. The other thing there is, just notice that they made a point of stressing it out, the conservation or enhancement of any social, moral, or spiritual values. Don't get confused. Go, wait a minute, I thought value was just a spirit word. What do you mean social values, moral values? Okay, spirit is value. And the fact that spirit is engaged, that unity is engaged to individuality and leads to associativity. Things can, in a derivative fashion, can have value, right? The social value is, society has value. The moral value, morality, has value. But spirit is value. Remember, value is literally a property of spirit substance. Okay, so you're using the word value, see, twice in an indirect mode and once in a direct mode. And you got to keep that sorted out in your head. So,
value that is value has value.
it's worth pointing out how, all the time you're being challenged in the book to not blur things together. And they're not going to... they're not going to help you by saying social value, moral value, spiritual value. They're just going to use the word value once, and you've got to keep it separated properly in your head. So, be on your toes when you're reading this book. Okay?
Pre-religious praying was part of the mana practices of the Melanesians, the Uda beliefs of the African Pygmies, and the Manitou superstitions of the North American Indians. The Baganga tribes of Africa have only recently emerged from the mana level of prayer. In this early evolutionary confusion, men pray to gods, local and national, to fetishes, amulets, ghosts, rulers, and to ordinary people.
Okay, so the initial very anthropological stuff there. That's, remember, when we're going on, way, way back again to when all you really have is very directly a religion of matter. If there's some sense of quote-unquote spirits, it's just nature spirits, right? It's not ghost cult spirits. And so, that's mostly what you're talking about there, is these very primitive, what they're calling pre-religious ideas, because they are kind of just the awe factor about the fancy notions you have about the material objects around you and the forces or the powers that they exude or whatever. Okay, like mana. Okay, so that's. That's one way to think kind of precisely about it. Just go all the way back to when you've got nature worship, right? And, and what kind of praying there would be when it's just nature worship. But there's going to be praying because you don't even need anything that you'd call worship like they're pointing out at the beginning. You'll just start playing off of this praying programming without anything fancy in your head. Yeah. Yep.
Choice of words,
mana
practices.
Mana, not mana.
Sorry.
Two ends is mana. Different thing. Different thing, that mana stuff. like in the Bible.
It is.
Yeah.
What is the difference?
No. This is mana. This is a woo woo power notion about the forces of nature, if you will. Okay, this is not manna from heaven stuff. Totally different. Like I said, see, this is all very, very primitive ideas. It's just in what ways they, you know, and again, remember what they're mostly trying to explain is luck, you know, good luck and bad luck, especially bad luck. Oh, I got some bad luck there. That's got to be Uda. There's Uda again, you know, giving us bad luck. Right, and some Christian is going to hear that, and they're not going to think properly in a, you know, nature worship mode, and they're going to think, oh, that's their name for the devil. It's like, no, they're not in some advanced, you know, ghost cult mode like that, okay? Right? They're just back in some primitive, you know, superstitious woo-woo about nature, okay? And Uda did it. Yeah. Okay, but anyway, then the final statement there. So you just, you know, they just drag you forward into all the complexities that we've been reading about, you know, and so you'll just have this hodgepodge of, you know, all kinds of different modes of prayer. You know, and you think about stones and hills and, you know, and animals. You know, we went through all that stuff that you worship, you know, the prayer that's associated with all that, including humans, right? And eventually you were worshiping man. And so, right, there's going to be, you know, prayer and all that. So all of that, you know, that prayer gets universalized to just everything that's you've ever been concerned about or you've thought is fancy or whatever. It's just going to get applied to everything. Fetishes, amulets, ghosts, rulers, you know, whatever. And again, it can do, remember, the reason it can just be applied universally like that is because it has no environmental predicate. It's just purely internal, so you can point it out at anything. It's like the sixth adjutant. You can be zealous about anything. Just pick something and direct your sixth adjutant at it. See, it's totally in your hands. You know, what prayer gets identified to or what the sixth adjutant gets identified to. You know, you're not limited by, you know, it only has a predilection towards that and that and that. It doesn't have any predilection. It's totally in your hands what it gets directed at.
Well, there's a similar thing with power has the interesting effect on people. People that just seem very normal when they're in the presence of someone who's own power figure,
mm-hmm.
they just fall all over themselves and
mm-hmm.
Exalting these people.
Right. Yeah. You know, and they're very impressed, and you know, and you want the best for them. It's like, you know, I need to pray for that, you know, that fancy person. You know, we can't help ourselves that way. And again, it doesn't mean that this stuff it doesn't have its appropriateness. I mean, prayer is very important. In the whole first half, you know, it's not just the indispensable in the second half. So just because we're talking very frankly about prayer, don't ever lose sight of just how important this is, you know, that you pray for your nation, that you know, pray for your leaders, you know, I mean, all that stuff is very important, right? And there's various spots in the book where you're talking about such things, and they mention that, right? Right? You have to look at prayer with an evolutionary eye, like it hasn't been looked at before. It's been over-existentialized. And you need to see all of the evolutionary aspects of prayer and then seek for, well, what about a prayer that really is transcendent or attempting to transcend space and time and matter? You know, is there a possibility for that? Are you curious at all? All right, let's see if we can get this first section in here.
1. Primitive prayer. The function of early evolutionary religion is to conserve and augment the essential social, moral, and spiritual values which are slowly taking form. This mission of religion is not consciously observed by mankind, but it is chiefly affected by the function of prayer. The practice of prayer represents the unintended but nonetheless personal and collective effort of any group to secure, to actualize, this conservation of higher values. But for the safeguarding of prayer, all holy days would speedily revert to the status of mere holidays.
Okay. Starting to give us some...
Seems like that's happening.
Yeah, give us some fun stuff to think about here. Notice that they're using conserve right here now. The function of early evolutionary religion is to conserve and augment the essential social, moral, and spiritual values which are slowly taking form. Okay, so that's kind of just reminding again right up front that don't ever lose sight of the evolutionary importance of all this. But then it says, see, this mission of religion is not consciously observed by mankind, like I've been trying to stress. In the beginning, okay, it's at best the shadow, not the substance, right, that's driving people, okay? But nonetheless, it plays this role. The practice of prayer represents the unintended, but nonetheless, personal and collective effort of any group. And then notice how they say secure, but then they parenthetically say to actualize this conservation. So we have these potentials built into us, and prayer is programmed in it as part of the way we will naturally actualize some of those potentials in us. Ever more so, you know, like I say, piling up this pile of sand so that you can stand on the top of the sand pile and then flip 180 degrees and stand on the rock of eternity. Okay, and then like they said, but for the safeguarding of prayer, all holy days would speedily revert to the status of mere holidays. I mean, I love it when they give you very definitive little, you know, physics statements like that. you know, so that you can, notice there's no wiggle room, right? I mean, it's very definitive. That's one of the, there are sometimes if the revelators are playing off of a human source work in something they're saying, if you actually look at the parallel in the human source work, the human author has some kind of fuzzy statement. And the revelators say, no, actually, we're going to use that statement, but we're going to take your fuzzy out of it. That's actually precisely exactly that, right? It's like, no, it's not just sometimes tribulation leads to wisdom. No, it's the only way, right? you're getting a little inkling of it. Let me clear up your, maybe you're just being humble. And it's like, well, I don't know if for absolutely certain if that's the only way. So I'll give some shades of gray in my sentence. The revelators, it's the authoritative, elimination of error. Yeah. No, they can just tell you. So now you don't have any confusion. You've got a solid object that you can, a solid element that you can work with in your thinking. That's the way it is, period. End of story. Now build on that. Don't sit there for endless centuries, wondering, well, what if, maybe, and blah, 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 Just, it's definitive. Now build on it. And see the degree to which, like John was saying, the degree to which you secularize things, and so obviously, prayer gets evaporated, if not outlawed. You can't pray in school or whatever, right? It's just all going to go to, and pretty soon, you're trying to ever more de-sanctify what you call purification of the holiday. It's like, well, I don't know. I don't know about that Christmas cookie. I think that's a violation of separation of church and state. And it gets to these insanity things that we've got going on these days, right? As you attempt to purify it, to have a pure nothing. The primitive people that you're trying to move away from, well, at least they had a something they were trying to purify. Okay, yours is worse. You're trying to purify a nothing.
sanctity of nihilism.
Nice. You're trying to sanctify nihilism, yes. Exactly. Yeah, and like I've pointed out, that's not primitivism, that's pre-primitivism. No, you can go all the way back to Anna Infanta. No one was ever, you know, even the back-mated people, you know, subsequent to that, no one was trying to sanctify nihilism. Only a sophisticated, you know, unfortunately free will individual like us can go pre-primitive like that. All right.
Religion and its agencies, the chief of which is prayer, are allied only with those values which have general social recognition, group approval. Therefore, when primitive man attempts to gratify his baser emotions or to achieve unmitigated selfish ambitions, he was deprived of the consolation of religion and the assistance of prayer. If the individual sought to accomplish anything antisocial, he was obliged to seek the aid of non-religious magic, resort to sorcerers, and thus be deprived of the assistance of prayer. Prayer, therefore, very early became a mighty promoter of social evolution, moral progress, and spiritual attainment.
Okay, see, so we, you know, see how we've gone back and we're talking about that whole, you know, whether it's white magic or black magic, you know, issue and stuff. But they're adding in the prayer element that we, you know, we didn't, you know, have in play before, and how critical that is to the differential between what's been called white and black. You know, because like they say in the opening opening sentence, religion has a number of agencies, but the chief is prayer. Right? As I think everyone should be able to acknowledge, if that isn't self-evident. It ought to be. We all know that prayer is very, very, very fixation phenomenon in religious circles. You know, and of course, you know we're going to begin to talk about how religionists get over-fixated. Let's see, what else do we have there?
You've got those three at the end.
Oh, yeah, right, you've got... again, we see this social, moral, and spiritual. They keep playing these up, you know, more and more here. You know, and then giving you fun things like social evolution, moral progress, and spiritual attainments, you know, and get you to reflect on the difference of the nouns there. Right? See that, you know, and we could talk about that for 10 minutes. Right? I mean, there's always such a richness like that. But the more you can understand why it doesn't say moral attainment and spiritual progress. In this particular instance, it's not like they don't say spiritual progress in other places, but why don't they say it here? What, you know, what contrastive point are they trying to make? The more you can get it, the more you'll strike step with the truth that's flowing through the paragraph. Right?
But this is a midwayer, so he's not quite as...
Yeah, but still. Yeah.
I'm sure somebody edited
it. it's just... that whole understanding of how spirit relates to you, you know, that, you know, spirit is not your substance right now, right? So it's something you're reaching up to, attempting to attain. See, all those sorts of things, you know, spend some time in your own reflecting on those and see if you can understand it better. Let's see, but this whole issue of, you know, attempting to gratify his baser emotions, I thought I should highlight that because I often, you know, use almost that exact expression. Remember that the adjutants, just in them of themselves as energies, before you think of them as spirit of something. Like the third adjunct, before you think of it as a spirit of courage, and you think about it as the energy of loyalty, every time I bring this up, do I not say, well, let's see, I could be lower to my you know, baser instincts. Right? See, they're reminding you of that. Right? All of those adjutants can be oriented, you know, selfishly down or unselfishly up. And... they're pointing out that prayer Because fundamentally what it is that's programmed into you is a conspiratorial ladder, right? You climb genuine prayer, that ladder up. When you bring prayer in, it actually unconsciously is helping with this orientation of the adjutant, whether it's pointed down selfishly or up unselfishly. Prayer actually, yeah, without you knowing it, is getting you to orient it, your adjutants better, get them directed upward. And so that's what they're getting at there.
Purposely put in you, as you said.
Yeah, yeah, right. Because initially, I mean, you don't know, you're not an adult of God, you don't know the difference between up and down. You know, not to mention you're very, you know, self-focused to begin with. You know, your natural tendency is, you know, is to put yourself first. Okay, so you need there needs to be some conspiracy built into you that, in spite of yourself, you'll find this orientation, you know, flipping, and you know, the loyalty, for instance, will be directed more upward, until eventually you can kind of, oh, I just noticed that loyalty is actually directed upward. Oh, that's appropriate. I'm going to notice that now, and I'm going to see to it continuing upward. See, now you're really climbing that ladder of prayer and can get up to Thanksgiving, and through Thanksgiving can get to worship. Like we've been talking. Oh, that reminds me, talking about climbing up that ladder. There was something there in the fourth paragraph in the preface. I was going to mention, kind of out of context here, but it's important. You know, notice when they said about the Tota tribe there, and they said, just as did the early peoples before the times of religious consciousness. Right? Remember, genuine religious consciousness is on the sixth level of meaning. And I was talking about that earlier. You know, so just kind of feed it into what we're just saying here again. I mean, there has to be some, doesn't have to be very, you know, literally directly substantive relationship with the sixth level, but you have to at least get to where you're playing with the shadows that the sixth level casts, instead of just playing with the substance of the second level and delusionally thinking it's the substance of the sixth. Okay? Yeah, so that's what they're, you know, and when you get that, even though there's no adult of God, we can still call that child of God's prayer genuine, because they're beginning to play off the shadow that the sixth level, the genuine religious consciousness, casts down as some feeling, for instance, on the second level of meaning. Okay, back to the content here.
But the primitive mind was neither logical nor consistent. Early men did not perceive that material things were not the province of prayer. These simple-minded souls reasoned that food, shelter, rain, game, and other material goods enhanced the social welfare, and therefore they began to pray for these physical blessings. While this constituted a perversion of prayer, it encouraged the effort to realize these material objectives by social and ethical actions. Such a prostitution of prayer, while debasing the spiritual values of a people, nevertheless directly elevated their economic, social, and ethical mores.
So at the same time they're saying all these positive evolutionary things, they're using pretty stark words spiritually. Wow. You know, perversion of prayer. Remember, I used it a little bit ago. That literally means turned all the way through. In other words, 180 degrees. Okay, these other strong things, prostitution of prayer, debasing the spiritual values of the people. So, you know, they're pointing out that once you go beyond that very initial kind of purely innocent stage, and you start, your imagination starts getting cranked up, and you start playing off of illusions and stuff, you actually start to actively negate some of what that very, very simple, innocent child has by grace, you know, which is kind of, you know, deep down a religion of spirit. Okay, but that's just way too abstract. And so once you start having any sort of conscious engagement of this, boom, it becomes a religion of matter, like they're saying, and the prayer is all about physical issues. And then it's got to slowly, over countless generations, work its way up to a conscious religion of spirit.
And Paul didn't help that. You know, pray for something in God's name.
Yeah. Not to
mention. We'll tell you how many people just believe that.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah. Right.
And right. If you don't pray for it, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. No. It's just you know, as they say these things, you know, you're just going, yeah, okay, yeah. Not only does everyone I know pray like that, I guess, you know, I'll be. Courageous and admit I pray that way, the same way too. Again, don't beat yourself up about that. Just that's the way it's supposed to be to begin with. It's not evil that everything went physical like they're talking about here. It's good. The evolutionary process is getting going. It has to start at the bottom and work its way up.
A lot right? of people pray for their team to win the game.
Right? Right? And notice what they said, you know, how the power of prayer, quote unquote, in these early stages, it encouraged the effort to realize these material objectives by social and ethical actions. Right? You know, the team prays together, it gets everyone focused in a social mode, like they're saying, social action, and they win. Is it because literally God, you know, stacked the deck? No. Okay. Right? But that's their point. Yeah, it's an incredible conspiracy that's designed into you, this prayer thing that the life carrier is designed into you. I mean, it just has so many, they're just pointing out, it has so many different ways that it produces a benefit completely in spite of all your foolish notions. Right? In the early stages of the evolutionary process, it does so many great things. You know, and humans are just oblivious to, you know, the reality of the whole thing.
For the better.
right, for the better. Yep.
Do you think prayer helps align your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if a team, for example, were praying together, maybe it was helping balance out their mind, or maybe you're praying for someone at a hospital,
Can calm your mind and focus your mind and get everyone on the same page if you're praying as a group. And there's just so many, you know, useful aspects to it, physically, socially, et cetera, mentally.
The changes to the petition.
Right.
Not the gospel.
But all of that, like I said, is, you know, this prayer programming thing, it helps to coordinate a useful pile of sand, right, that you can stand on the top of so that you can actually reach the upper domain and choose to now rotate 180 degrees, you know, to reverse that perversion, right, that you've been turned 180 degrees that whole time as you've been building that pile of sand. Right? Now you can choose to flip it 180 degrees back to what the little initial hint of the grace encirclement was giving you. And you go, oh yeah, now that I think about it, the arrow that was given to me, my grace was pointed that direction. You get this positive feedback once you actually rotate it that way. You know it's the right direction. Right? Because that direction was already put into you by grace at roughly age 6. And even though you kind of immediately flipped it, you know, and had to work through this whole process, backing into truth, remember like they talk about? Okay. Eventually, you know, you can rotate it, de-pervert it. All right?
Prayer is only monologuous. Monologuous in the most primitive type of mind. It early becomes a dialogue and rapidly expands to the level of group worship. prayer signifies that the pre-magical incantations of primitive religion have evolved to that level where the human mind recognizes the reality of beneficent powers or beings who are able to enhance social values and to augment moral ideals, and further, that these influences are superhuman and distinct from the ego of the self-conscious human and his fellow mortals. True prayer does not, therefore, appear until the agency of religious ministry is visualized as personal.
Okay. So it goes, you know, it starts in that monologue mode, like they were saying. Monologous. like analogous. But you know, like they're saying, it early becomes a dialogue. Okay. And rapidly expands, as they're saying. Okay, remember how they kind of mentioned that way back there in that, what was that, that second paragraph? Yeah, of the preface, you know, that process, where it becomes groupified. But then, you know, you've got that whole issue, like they're saying there, you know, it signifies that the pre-magical incantations of primitive religion have evolved into that level where the human mind recognizes the reality of beneficent powers or beings who are able to enhance social values. See that, you know, the more you, you know, things get elevated and you start to get ideas, if you will, about ideals. Start to get some sense of ideals, and then these higher concepts get going. That there's beneficence flows down from above, and I can seek to supply favorable conditions as my rationalizations keep dictates for how that beneficence can flow down upon us in the tribe or whatever. So all that starts by, you know, you get a little bit of that higher sense, like we were saying. You start to play with shadows that are coming down from higher substance. Okay, and let's see, we continue on there. That these influences are superhuman and distinct from the ego of the self-conscious human and his fellow mortals. She's all of that. She just, you know, see, we've talked about that whole evolution, but they're reminding you of how much prayer very directly fosters this evolutionary process. And like I was saying, because it just has this tendency to produce some upward orientation, kind of in spite of yourself. And so things progress. So true prayer does not, therefore, appear until the agency of religious ministry is visualized as personal. In the italicized personal. You see, and there's no way you can visualize the agency as personal until you get some initial recognition of yourself as personal. And that gets us back to the very first paragraph, see, of the preface, like we talked about there. Once you get a little bit of a genuine personal self-consciousness, because your want to anthropomorphize your concept of God, you've got a higher sense of yourself, and so you project that out into God, and that's actually a positive development, right? God ceases to be just a fancy animal, and he starts to become a person.
Yeah, I'm just curious about the second sentence where it sort of mm-hmm. expands to the level of group worship. That, you know, it's the first time they sort of mention worship in this section on prayer.
Uh-huh.
Is that kind of the worship that we've been talking about earlier, or is it more of just a group prayer versus group worship.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, just the very fact that you say group worship, you know that the worship isn't that genuine thing on the sixth level of meaning. I mean, because it's group, it's an outer life phenomenon, right? But it, that group sanctified ritual, right, that we call worship, and so I think, how did they say it back there when they were talking about, next, these believers in luck would enlist the support of their friends and families, and presently some form of ceremony would be performed, which included the whole clan or tribe. You see, it's another way of referring to what they're talking about there. Okay, but anyway, yeah, back to here. Notice the, you know, we had genuine prayer. Now we have true prayer. So even though, you know, again, the individual is not doesn't have a hold of the substance in any direct way, by grace, there's not just the genuine part, but there's the true context for that part that begins to cast a shadow down and effectively be a motivation for your life. Okay. So, again, it's just, it's another way of emphasizing the contrast to, if I focus on what primitive prayer isn't, you know, or how primitive it is, you know, we can all quickly lose sight of how even these lowly, limited facts of us have been genuinely sanctified by grace, by our encirclement of the Holy Spirit. What the most ignorant, primitive child does can't help but actually be better than it seems, because of that encirclement by grace, that sanctification in the Holy Spirit, right, by grace. So, they're reminding you to not totally divorce words like genuine and true and stuff, or real, from the early phase. Right? In the same way that we're calling it worship, even though it isn't substantively worship, you know, in the genuine sense. Or we're calling it religion. You know, we're calling this stuff the evolution of religion, when, you know, okay, it's all outer life stuff. It isn't really religion at all, you know, technically. Okay. But in truth it is. Okay, a little more here.
Prayer is little associated with animism, but such beliefs may exist alongside emergent religious sentiments. Many times religion and animism have had entirely separate origins.
This is just a little aside. Remember how we talked about animism before? You know, in contrast to, you know, whether or not religion was kind of getting going in basically just that nature animistic way, you know, there's just spirit and everything, you know, that animistic thing. You know, and then in contrast that, you have the more individuated ghost cult ideas, right? They're just reminding you of, you know, prayer's relationship to that. It doesn't say it's not associated, but little associated with animism. When they're talking about the prayer and the nature stuff in some of those anthropological settings in the preface, right? Those are pretty animistic settings, right? When you don't have, you know, notions of spirit beings and things. So they're just reminding you of that complexity, and that you can have different origins, you know, for the two modes, and you can have them interplaying in different ways. You know, they're just reminding you of that complexity, and that prayer is right in the midst of all that complexity. We talked about the complexity, but we didn't talk before about how prayer is right there in the midst of that. So they're just reminding you of that.
Is there a difference between animism and pantheism?
Yeah. Pantheism. All God-ism.
Everything is,
you know, you haven't gotten to God yet when you're merely animistic.
It's just spirit.
Yeah, it's just a spirit fuzz notion, you know. You don't, it's not God. You know, you don't think of that as God in everything. You know, the God is everything. It, you know, it's just a woo-woo spirit notion, you know, everything. You know. All right. Maybe one other little thing. Remember, technically, it's not so much, quote-unquote, spirit. Everything is spirit, but everything is living. I mean, that's, you know, animism, like life animation, right? You know, you're noticing the life of living things, and then, you know, you play off the illusion that everything is alive like that, the rocks and everything. And that's animism. So you're just spreading literal life animation recognition, you know, throughout everything. And all the mystery of that, you know, what is that life animation?
The hills are alive.
Yeah, the hills are alive, right. Yeah, with the sound of music, right. I see, I mean, the very fact that you sing like that, see, that's playing off of animism, right, where you literally thought that the hills were alive. We just use it metaphorically, not literally now. Yep, yeah, good point.
With those mortals who have not been delivered from the primitive bondage of fear, there is a real danger that all prayer may lead to a morbid sense of sin, unjustified convictions of guilt, real or fancied. But in modern times, it is not likely that many will spend sufficient time at prayer to lead to this harmful brooding over their unworthiness or sinfulness. The dangers attendant upon the distortion and perversion of prayer consist in ignorance, superstition, crystallization, devitalization, materialism, and fanaticism.
Okay, interesting way to leave ourselves here tonight, but this will set the stage. You know, they've given us all of this initial stuff, and they want to end the beginning with danger. Okay, there is a real danger. You know, they say at the beginning, and these dangers attendant upon. Okay, the very fact that they say perversion of prayer, it's like, oh, that it must be, you're going to be dominated by self instead of by the cosmos. That's the literal domination of this danger, because it's turned 180 degrees. It's like, well, why does prayer foster this unfortunate state? Because even in its most advanced, most genuine, most true state, prayer is self-reminding, not self-forgetting like worship. Right? So there's always a potential danger. You don't have to actualize it, okay? There's a potential danger in prayer inescapably, innately, because it's technically self-reminding. So it can always be carried too far to an unfortunate state of introspection, like they're talking about there, lead to a morbid sense of sin, right? I'm just diseased. You know, I'm by nature sinful and unclean, right? Unjustified convictions of guilt, real or fancied, right? It doesn't have to be any reality to, like this, like we're talking about, with transgression of taboo being the definition of sin, and all of your basically animal guilt stuff that we, you know, call our awareness of sin. Yeah, so all, you know, prayer can, you know, you can take all of that and make it very, very problematically worse. And then they point out, yeah, but, you know, remember, you guys are so de-religiousized and secular now, and so, you know, concerned with material comforts and stuff. None of you, you know, are going to be fixated enough to pray enough in order to get that hopelessly, you know, introspective. Right? There's some fancy new widget you need to go shopping for today, you know? You don't have time for prayer.
So it's still hopeless.
Yeah, that was 100 years ago.
They're pointing out that it's not all bad that you are kind of unfortunately, secularized now, because you've been, whether you want it or not, have been made a little bit more spiritual by the evolutionary process. So it would be even easier now for prayer to be dangerous. And if you were all like gazing at your navel in a monastery, it could be really bad. Yeah. That's what they're telling you. So maybe in your difficult adolescent phase here, it's not all bad that you're focused on a lot of material comfort issues.
Aren't there some sects, though, that still...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See, and of course, that's when they point out in places in the book that, just how much evil religionists have wrought because of prayer. Those really strong statements that are in the book. Okay? See, and they're reminding you this. There's real danger here. Real danger, see? And we're not talking, it's talking about evil. Okay? It's a tool that the more you take it out of just the genetic programming mode and put it in your own hands, you need to understand the physics of this. You can easily worsen yourself with this newly discovered tool if you apply it inappropriately. Just like any tool, it's really handy driving a nail into a board, that hammer thing. But if you use it on your head, not so handy, right? Every tool is like that, okay?
Right? And
that prayer is a tool, right? A tool to get you up through Thanksgiving to worship. Okay. And the more you think about it as a tool, not an end in itself, right, the better it'll be, the less danger there is. Yeah. All right. So we'll pick up there next time. You can. I'll leave it to you to contemplate the ignorance, superstition, crystallization, devitalization, materialism, and fanaticism there. not to be flippant about it, but please do. We already went 15 minutes over just to do this little bit. All right, we could talk for endless hours about all this stuff. So, I hope all of you spend some time on your own, working on some of these details yourself.
Years.
Yeah. It will always be better if you can unpack it than you listening to me unpack it. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.